History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned over the years is they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and of course, invest enough time to listen patiently as memories from long ago take on new meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today we have the privilege of meeting 99-year-old Bill Glaspy of Bakersfield, California. He made it through the Battle of the Bulge and the rest of the war in Europe with the 468th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. His job was to fire at enemy planes from M-15 or M-16 half-tracks. We'll hear some of Bill's memories from those days, but as always, we like to go back even earlier.
Well, I grew up in, you might say, eastern Arizona, up around Winkman, up through there in the 30s. I went to school in there. But we traveled. My dad worked on ranches. In fact, their family owned a big ranch in Arizona at one time. And rather than work on his own ranch, he'd work on other people's ranches. Out of 8 boys and 4 girls, we had 3 covered wagons. I don't know, about 4 milk cows. Mama had her chickens, her hogs. We hauled everything that we could on the wagon. My dad would build a box underneath, put the chickens in that, and needless to say, us boys would herd the hogs and the cows down the road as we go. Some days we'd make a good day's work would be about 10 miles. Some days we'd make 3 miles. Trouble, trouble, trouble. Them old wagons, them old wagon spokes would dry out. We'd come to the river, well, we'd have to take the wheels off and soak them good. But it was, to me, to us kids, it was a lot of fun. It was something. But I know it was pretty hard on my mom and dad.
And I'm just imagining somebody who just tuned in and they heard you talking about covered wagons and they're saying, wait, how old is this guy? They don't realize that there could be someone alive today who actually operated that way. And you said 8 boys and 4 girls. So where did you fit into that lineup?
I was the 6th from the top, and there was 6 below me. I was, let's see, it's Howard, Tom, Celia, Roy, and Vera, and then me. Then the little guys, or we call them little guys, Merle, Dorothy, Jim, Mabel, Kenneth, and Robert. That was all below me. They're all gone now, but just Kenneth and I were the only two left. Now, I'll be 100 years old in December, if the Lord tarries, if I live that long. And the way it's going now, maybe I'll make it.
Well, you must be doing something right. I've got to ask, though, with that many siblings, you must have all gotten along perfectly all the time, right?
Well, we fought like cats and dogs. But, you know, it was, I guess it's like that with everybody. We fought like cats and dogs in our own group, but somebody outside come in and he had his hands full if he picked on one of the guys. Of course, us kids go to school, and I was one of the lucky ones. I had an older brother taking care of us little guys. So I didn't have too much trouble going to school. I didn't learn much. I was too busy looking at other things, and especially girls. But that didn't help me a whole lot. It didn't give me an education. But after I got out of the service, I was discharged in December the 19th, 1945. In Fort Bliss, Texas, and in 1947, I married my wife. We went to Arkansas, and I went back to this GI school, and I learned more in 8 months in that one little spot than I did in 8 years in grammar school. But the teachers had more time to fool with the pupils, you know. And that one teacher said, I'm going to teach you to do arithmetic. if it takes us all year. She just brought her a chair and sat down. Well, by the time I had to leave, I could do a little bit, you know. But seventh grade education is all I've got. But the Lord's been good to me. He's kept me going, give me a real good family. My wife passed away in 2017. Lost a boy in 2011. But I still got four. I've got two boys and two girls, this one and an older girl. And I consider myself real lucky. All the time I went through there, of course, I took all my basic training when I went into service. I went in 43, and all of my training was taken right here in California.
Well, I want to ask you about even before that, you know, because most of us didn't live through the Great Depression. Most of us certainly never had to take care of spokes on a wagon wheel to make sure you could get where you were going. And most of us didn't grow up in a family as big as yours either. Are there some memories you have from those years that stand out now of what you loved about it or what was challenging about it?
Well, there's some things that I remember real well. Me and my brother, just younger than me, was always getting into trouble. My grandpa would buy Prince Albert tobacco in that pound can, and of course we'd go down and help ourselves to some of his tobacco and go off in the woods and smoke. But my dad caught us one time, and when he got through with us, we didn't smoke for about 2 hours. But we didn't have sense enough just to leave it alone. We went back down, and it wasn't no time till we got caught again. And I never in my life heard him say, "This is going to hurt me worse than does you." He didn't just pat you a little bit. He'd give you a whipping, and you knew you had a whipping. But everything seemed to work out. There's times. One time in particular, I remember my younger brother and I was down in what I call the cow pasture. But there's a little dry wash run down through there, and a couple of trees and an old log bin there. We're sitting there smoking, and there's one of them old sand lizards come by, and their tail is curled up over the back. And they just work back and forth like that. He said, "I bet you I can stop that lizard's tail from working." He shot that thing and hit, went right over, and that big old lizard headed toward us. You talk about a foot race. We had a foot race. That lizard was coming after. But there's just things like that, you know. Sometimes I can remember things real plain. Other times they just fade away. I don't know. And some of them old-time things I can remember. I know when we was going to school in Dudleyville, they call it, in Winkleman, Arizona, my mom wanted to have our horses saddled and have groceries on the saddles for, we'd take them up to the cow camp over the weekend. And outside of that, there just wasn't a whole lot going on. Always something to do, wood and water to get for the wash pots. But it was just, you know, to us guys, it was the good type. But I know with Mom and Dad, it was rough. But I've seen her take, she used the Dutch oven. And even on a big stove, she'd use some of her Dutch ovens put on top. But she could fix up a meal in about 30 minutes. It'd just make your lips slip. Boy, it was good. Biscuits and gravy, all of that kind of stuff. But it's just been a real good life for me, all the way from there here. Then I went into the service in September 1943. I don't remember just what day.
Well, there is one date I want to ask you about, because it seems like a lot of people have a specific memory of how they found out. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard that news?
1941, yeah. That same time, our house burnt in Avondale, Arizona. And a friend of mine, I was in Lordsburg, New Mexico. We caught the bus. We'd went over there to get a job. They'd work. We caught the bus and went home. And when we got home, we didn't have a thing. And how in the world my mom built back like she did, I don't know. But it wasn't long after that till I got a letter from Uncle Sam. He said, "We want you in the service." And I was in there. I thought it's going to be something, you know, get to go in there and just really have a good time, but it wasn't all that good. All of that basic training, I mean, they was there with you all the time. But it wasn't too bad. The Army, I was making $50 a month, and the Army said, "If you send $50, we'll send $50 home." Well, 1 month I had $4 and something left. But they had what they call rations, and I'd get my cigarettes and stuff like that through that. So it made pretty good. Then we got out here on Camp Irwin. We was out there. We was taking that training, and I thought sure we was going to North Africa because the way they was training desert. We had to crawl with our rifles on our arms like this. And I actually believe every one of them little greasewood bushes had a rattlesnake in it. Them old sidewinders. I'm telling you, you'd see guys moving around this, and they were shooting live ammunition just 30 inches over your head. We pulled out that, and I went and made the deal again. They was having a meeting in the mess hall. I stepped up the door, and the captain was standing there, and the first sergeant was standing there. He said, take this guy to the medics. I didn't feel bad. I didn't know what was wrong with me at all. I felt pretty good. But I went, and they put me in the ambulance. It was me and two other guys. We come all the way from there, all the way back to Camp Hunt. Then they had appendix operation. After that, they gave me that spinal shot. I was in bed for 45 days. I couldn't move from the waist down. But I got out of a lot of them long rat races, they called them. Uh-huh. They had one, it was a 25-mile rat race, and you had to full pack, and you had to walk just fast as you could walk. I got out of that. Of course, I did have to take a 25-mile hike, but it wasn't that bad. But it wasn't too bad. Then we got that new commander. Wasn't long to lay load us up. One of our trains went up in through Canada, down to New York. And our train went by. I stopped in Avondale, Arizona. We stopped for an hour, just a quarter of a mile from where I live. My sister and one of her little friends was up there, and I hollered. But they wouldn't let me off to go see my mom. Just afraid I wouldn't come back. And I might not, I don't know. But it wasn't too bad. We went through, all the way through to Miles Standish. We moved from New York up to that.
How many of your brothers were also in the service?
There was two of them in the Army with me and one in the Navy. But during the Battle of the Bulge, they pulled us all up on a little incline. And where the Battle of the Bulge was fought, there was a little hill like. And the Germans was back on one side, the Americans on the other side. And I seen both of my brothers' companies, but I couldn't find them. Our captain come and pulled us back. But if the Germans had broke through, we'd been talking different language today. They were that close. I don't know. But after that, we went from there. Well, let's see. I went from Glasgow, Scotland.
Well, let me, sorry for interrupting, but I'm curious to know about, you know, your journey overseas. Had you ever been on a ship before you got on that one?
No, and I'm going to tell you, it was a ship. Third largest ship in the world at that time. British Aquitania. And we got out. I don't know. They told us that we left Boston. We went up toward Greenland and just made kind of a big circle. And they said the reason they'd done that, they was outrunning those German submarines. And I had no idea the Germans was that close to U.S. anyhow. But we got, everything went back. We got out there, I don't know how far we was out. We was up on A deck, and that we hit one of those swells. I began to think that thing wasn't going to stop going up. When it come down, I didn't think it was going to stop going down. Water come plumb up over the top of that big boat. I told the squad leader, I said, I'm going back to the cabin. I'm going to lay down. Do you know, on that whole trip, I never did get real sick. But I went down to get some food one time, and the English people was fixing their kidney stew. And you can smell it a long ways before you ever get to it. So I just bought me a candy bar and soda and went back up to my apartment. But it wasn't a bad, you know. There'd be planes come over, and the friendly planes would all drop flares, let them know who English and the Canadian planes come through. But we got down, and the captain come told us, said, your crew's going to Glasgow, Scotland for a mail detail. Probably 6 weeks. But was there, I think, about 2 weeks. Went down to the post office one time. The officer there said, we don't need you guys. We got everything under control. So they just sent us over, and we got on that little boat, went across the English Channel.
Let me ask you a question. I don't know if it's easy to answer or not, or if you remember anything about this, but I've heard a lot of different answers when I ask guys this. Because here you are, you're going across the Atlantic. You know you're going to a war. Did you think you were ever going to make it back to America?
You know, it just didn't strike me that time. Till we got into France, then it really hit. Wonder if we're going to make it.
Well, this conversation is evidence that he made it, but it wasn't without close calls. We'll hear about some of those when we come back. If you'd like to see photos or some brief videos with this 99-year-old World War II veteran, Bill Glaspie, head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 99-year-old Bill Glaspie of Bakersfield, California, originally from Arizona. He spent time in quite a few other states in the years in between, but for 17 months during World War II, he was in Europe with the 468th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion.
And when you mentioned being pulled aside for this mail detail and that kept you there 2 weeks, are you saying without that you had been part of the initial landing force on D-Day?
I'm not really sure whether we'd been in on that or not. I don't think so. I think they were just about all through with that by the time we got out of Glasgow. But it was, I was on Omaha Beach, but we're just down there, you know, it's more or less sightseeing than anything else. We was going through, we made so many trips, and that Pat, when he got started, boy, he didn't know when to stop. Oh, he went. After we got over into, I don't know whether it was South France or West France or what, but they moved so fast, we'd pull off maybe for a snack or something like that, and by the time we got stopped, we'd get march order again. They were going so fast, there was one place we come to, that Hurdston Forest. We went through part of that, and there was people hanging in trees and everywhere, German soldiers. It was a mess, I'll tell you.
And tell me about this unit you were a part of. So the 468th AAA Anti-Aircraft Artillery. People can maybe read between the lines, but explain to me what your purpose was in that unit and what your specific role was.
I was a cannoneer, and our role was to keep the German planes out of the air. They sent them up, and we were supposed to bring them down. That's all we trained for, was just that. But they did have fixed the 50 caliber machine gun at 2,800 yards, could cut a track off a tank. And they had tracers, you know, every other bullet would be a tracer. And the Germans got to where they watched that and they could sneak under that. So they got to where they'd take the tracers out of the lower guns. They set kind of like that, cut it off on the 16 tank. We had two. They had the M16 and the M15. Which was two machine guns and a 37-millimeter cannon. But our first real action was in Saint-Désir, France. They put us up on, there was four tracks, two 15s and two 16s. and they just kind of put one here and one there, guarding a little dam. And that evening at about 6 o'clock, there's an airplane come through, and the order come to fire. All tracks opened up on that airplane about the same time, and it was just looked like he was trying to get away. There's so many bullets going in that he had it just rolling, just like that. Finally, went off, and I don't know how far he went, but I heard the next day there was two German generals on that plane. Reconnaissance planes, I think is what they called it. But that was our first taste of actual war.
And you guys shot them down?
Yeah, well, it was kind of spooky, too. But they pulled us in, and over in France, you know, all of their fence lines was hedgerows. And they pulled us into a place, an open space, and just on the other side of this hedgerow, there was a company of black guys. They had the 40 millimeters. And at night, about 9:30, 10 o'clock, the Germans had sent a plane around taking pictures, and they start dropping flares. Them guys opened up on one of them at about 10 o'clock at night. Boy, you talk about people hunting a foxhole. We got out of there in a hurry. It was something. But outside of that, I never did. I've been in some pretty tight spots, but I never got a scratch on me anywhere. And I lay that to my mama's prayers. I had a praying mama, and I know she prayed for me every night. But we just went all the way through in Munich, Germany, May of 1945. Well, they gave me a Bronze Star Medal. I got good conduct and a Victory Medal and a Bronze Star. And the captain said, that's for meritorious service. I asked my squad leader, I said, well, what does he mean? He said, you'll have somebody who knows, I don't know. But I got the star, and it gave me, boosted me up the line. They was discharging people by numbers, and boosted me up to 84. So that gave me, put my way on up the line. But we had it real easy in Munich, Germany. I was with the military government for a while, and they got just a little more authority than the MPs. We had to go out and check, and we had to walk. No jeeps. But we had a trail-like place just blazed out where we'd know most of the guys would go. We'd make our sound, come back in, go to bed. But it wasn't too bad. And then one morning they come up and said, you're going home. And the captain said, if you want to stick around for another month or two, we'll give you sergeant rating. I said, no, sir. I've had all this army off. I'm ready to go home.
Well, and you alluded earlier to the Battle of the Bulge, and you mentioned that both of your brothers were there, too, in different units. But there's some time that passes here from the time you get over across the channel at the end of June till December when the Bulge starts. You mentioned Patton pushing the pace and keeping you moving. But in that day-to-day, give us a taste of what that life was like. Where did you sleep? What were some of the things that, you know, that made an impression on you?
We had sleeping bags, and usually we stayed right close to our track all the time. Once in a while they'd move in close to a little shack or something like that, and we'd get to move in that. But we always had to have two guys on guard, one on the radio and one just to keep guard with the rifle. They pulled us up to a little hill. It was in Germany. There's a little shack there, and our crew was in that. And just about dusky dark, there was airplane come by. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. This plane come by, and a little bit it raised up. Well, the telephone poles was about 20 feet high, and you raised up over them. And I cut that double fuselage. You know, they had the P-38, mm-hmm. was double. And then they put out the P-61, and it was just a recon plane. And I met the pilot that flew that plane, 84, down in Mexico. But it was just something you just, and they told you, when they have dogfights, don't look up because them guys can see your face. But it's impossible. Them planes get to cutting up like that. You got to look up. Uh-huh. But I went through all of it without getting a scratch.
Well, and I'm sure that there were some moments, though, because you're talking about, you know, your first taste. You guys shot down that plane. I'm sure that wasn't the only plane you guys shot down.
No.
But those planes are also shooting at you, and then there's artillery, and there's mortars, and there's booby traps, and there's mines. I mean, there had to be some close calls that you encountered a time or two.
Yep. There was one time I can remember, we were attached to the paratroopers, And we're up on this little hill, and this sergeant had been down to headquarters, and he come back. And our track was sitting, oh, maybe it's close to me at that television from the road. This guy come by, and all of a sudden, he hit one of those mines. His back wheel went about 100 feet right straight up. Broke his legs. It didn't kill him, but it sure did mess him up. And the captain come around, and he said, now, you guys see what's happened. You've got to watch. But we had guys that go with them tanks. They put a deal on the front end tanks with chains where they could rotate, and they'd go through them minefields with them knocking them out. And then we'd go along behind them. In our complete outfit, there's one sergeant, Sergeant Vogt. He lost the track, but they captured, they got their new track, but they captured 600 Germans. But it was just, something I can't remember everything, you know, like I wish I could. But
what would you say in all your time over there, is there one moment or incident that you look back on and you say, that was my closest call? That's where my number almost got called?
Yeah, that's when we were attached to the field artillery. They pulled us up in them hills. They sent one German tank back. They knocked out three of those big guns, 8-inch guns. And so I heard, I don't know how true it is, but they said they killed 9 infantry boys back up in the hills. My foxhole was about 2.5, almost 3 feet deep. And I set my boots up in the top. Next morning, my boots were just riddled with shrapnel all through the top of my boots. So thank God I wasn't in my boots at that time.
Hey, man, I could see how that would get your attention. Did you have to deal with losing guys that you had gotten to know?
Just one, but it wasn't, you know, we captured a alcohol plant, and this big guy, he got to drinking, and they diluted down with orange juice and sugar and stuff like that. He got too much of it. About 6 weeks was all it was, and they killed him. And that's about the only thing with our group. We had, well, in our squad, there was 15 and 16 tanks. We never lost anybody out of all of them. There was some guys that got shot, but they didn't kill them or anything. They just got a Purple Heart out of it.
And with regard to the Bulge, I mean, this is a massive operation, right? There's hundreds of thousands of people involved in this. But specifically, where were you guys? You were called in to relieve Bastogne during the siege, is that right?
We were at a little place. I don't remember just what the name of the town was. But we got march order one morning, and I asked the squad leader, I said, well, where are we going? He said, I don't know for sure, but I think we're going to be up close to the Bulge. And it was just a little hill, kind of like this. And we were sitting right along about like that, and there was tanks, half tracks, all just lined up all the way up and down through there. And the captain come up and told our squad leader, said, well, you take your crew and go back. We don't need you up here. And why, I don't know. Have no idea, but went back, and there was the most modern town I'd ever seen. Nancy, France. Seemed like all of the big buildings was like these down here, big glass. But it was really nice. And we stayed there for, I think, about 4 or 5 days. Then we went back over. They took us in to Munich, Germany. That's where I stayed till we left.
And sorry for bouncing around here, but anytime I meet somebody who was involved in the Battle of the Bulge, I have to ask them how cold it really was and how you dealt with the cold.
Army give us a overcoat. It's almost big enough for a quilt. You could almost wrap it around. But we had what they call a long johns, and we had fatigue clothes, which was kind of like these. We stayed pretty warm. When we're traveling, usually there'd be two of us on the back, cannoneers, you know, right and left cannoneers. The gunner would sit in the turret. Those guys would squat down where the wind couldn't get to us. We made it pretty good through all of that. But it's, there have been times I'd like to went back, you know, just went taking that map and went right back the same way. But you'd have to have a house full of money in order to do that now.
Well, I do have a friend whose foundation is going to be taking guys like you over there next year for the 80th anniversary of D-Day. So if you're interested, I'd be happy to connect you. It looks like you get around pretty good, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm slowed down quite a little bit, but yeah, I went up, took the honor flight in 19, and my youngest son from Oregon went with me. Of course, he's 6 foot, a little over 200 pounds. They wouldn't let us walk. There was four or five of us, World War II guys. That Kevin McCarthy was our guide. He said, no, I said, you guys got guides here, you got people to help you around, you're going to ride in wheelchairs. So that's where we went. But it was one trip. If you ever get a chance, take it. It's worth it.
Well, let's talk a little more about that. So that's you went from here in Bakersfield, Honor Flight, Kern County. They do a phenomenal job. And Kevin McCarthy, now the Speaker of the House, meets every one of those flights and greets every veteran personally. You saw a lot of different things on that flight, on that experience in D.C. What stood out to you the most?
The thing that I thought of most was the people that didn't make it back. World War II, 405,000 people that didn't make it back. But it was, I never thought about it being that much, you know.
And the way they represent that there at the National World War II Memorial is that wall of gold stars, over 4,000 of them. Yeah. So there you are looking at that, and you know you and three of your brothers were involved in that war. What did you think about while you were looking at those gold stars?
I just don't know. But both my brothers are gone now. One of them lost a finger. He was working with the 105 millimeter howitzers. He went to pull a lock or something like that, and it slipped and cut his finger off like that. Yeah. Well, he got a Purple Heart out of that. The other one, he was in the war section with the 9th Army. My older brother was in the 35th Division, and my other brother was in the, he was in the 9th Army, I believe. But it was in, he was in the war section. Of course, I didn't get to see either one of them all this whole time I saw. Couldn't find them. My brother was in the Navy. He didn't stay too long.
But they all came home, and you heard Bill credit his mother's prayers for that. What was it like to see his mother again after the war? And what about General Patton, under whom he served in Europe? This 99-year-old also has a hobby that you might be able to get a taste of one of these weekends in Bakersfield, California. And we'll let Bill Glaspie explain when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
That is the unique sound of a dobro, played by 99-year-old Bill Glaspie. More on his musical endeavors in a moment. But first, let's hear what this World War II veteran and Battle of the Bulge survivor has to say about one of that era's most well-known military leaders.
General Patton, guy that nobody liked. But boy, that guy got the job done. I ain't kidding you.
Well, and I was told, our friend Arnold Martinez, who let me know about you, has been interviewing guys like you for a book project he's working on, and he told me that you had a good story about Patton. Now, did you get to meet him? Did you see him in person?
I seen him, but I didn't get to talk to him. Mm-hmm. We was down in a little canyon-like place, well, a little valley, and the hill on the side, and he always rode on them 6x5s, And he come up, he was standing up there, and this sergeant was standing there, I had a full beard. He just didn't stop completely. He slowed down real slow. He said, I'll be back in 30 minutes, and that so-and-so beard better be gone. Well, that old sergeant just whirled around right then, taking off. But I've heard some of his stories, and they're not pretty. Uh-huh. But when it come to fighting, that old boy got the job done. We went to his museum down in Southern California a while back, and my son, daughter-in-law, and my daughter here and I. And there's a lot of stuff about him that some of the stuff we didn't know then. But it's quite a place. If you've never been, get a chance to go. It's worth the trip.
Do they have his pearl-handled pistols on display there?
No. Well, you know, he gave one of them to one of those Hollywood ladies. Yeah, he had both them. But you know, he even sent some horses home from over there, them Arabian horses. But he had 3 stars up there. He could do just about anything he wanted to.
I'm just curious, because you were over there at a time where every day something new was being learned and discovered, and in the spring of 45, these concentration camps started to get liberated. Were you aware at all of what was happening and what the Nazis were doing in those camps?
We heard about it. They put out a little paper, and they brought up that Dachau and places like that, where all of the Jews was killed, you know, and all of that. But I never was right up close to them. Now, I've been to several of their prison camps where the Germans that had been captured was kept. But nothing happened. They were just a bunch of young guys like we were. And we never did get over in that part. I don't know, maybe Patton thought we wasn't. But we had a good record. Forrest's record goes, we had held up our end pretty close. The armored divisions is the guys that he was interested in more, because he'd take them. The 4th Armored, I think, was his special, because just about any time you heard of a hot battle, 4th Armored Division would be in there.
And what about coming home? You said, you know, they gave you the Bronze Star, and that gave you more points so you could come home sooner. But what was that journey home like, and what was it like to see your family again?
We left, it was something. There was a first lieutenant from Texas, and he was our commander on our trip home. He said, I've always wanted to go up into the Swiss Alps. So they had one of those big hunting camps, I call it, just a great big building. We went up and stayed all night, about halfway up on the hill. And it was so nice up there. It was just really nice. But the next day we went back down into France, place they call Camp Lucky Strike. Just scattered, pup tents and all of that, just scattered out. We was there for about 3 days. Then they put us on what they call a banana boat, American ship, 500 feet long and 65 feet wide. We got out about 2 days out in the Atlantic, and that sheriff pin dropped off, busted, and the prop fell off the back end. We was there for 2 days, and I mean that boat was, they had to wait till the them guys that goes on the water, they had to come out and put new prop, the whole bit on there.
So you've made it through almost a year in combat in Europe, through the Bulge, through VE Day. I didn't even ask you about VE Day. And now you're on your way home, and you're dead in the water getting tossed to and fro by the sea?
Yeah, boy, I'll tell you, the Navy would bring us out a little cup with a boiled egg and another one with a little piece of cornbread and one about like that with 2 swallows of coffee. They told us that, now you better get this down in a hurry. Well, you just had to take it like that. There was a major, Army major, come in. Sailor told him, said, sir, you need to hang on to that stuff, because when it goes, that's it. You don't get anything else till next meal. Oh, he said, we're all right. It won't bother. About that time, a wave hit, and all of his stuff went over against the wall on the other side. Sailor told him, said, sorry, sir, you can't do it. You should have held on to it. He didn't get anything either. But one guy got a broken leg out of the deal. He was trying to move around, and that it would just hit you just like that, just real quick.
This sounds pretty scary. How did you handle all that?
I stayed right by my bed most of the time. Yeah, only time I'd go ahead and get something to eat. Then I'd get right back to my where I could hang on to something. But we made it. After they got it fixed, we come on into Virginia. We got there, and it was about 7 or 8 o'clock in the afternoon. And they unloaded the boat, went in, and bought. I had the best meal you'd want to think about. Went and took a shower and shaved and had a real nice bed. Boy, we slept like dogs. Next day, they put us on the truck, went to Fort Bliss, Texas, walked up that place, and this lieutenant standing there, she said, called my name, said, here's your discharge. She just signed the bottom of it, gave me $300, said, you're out of the Army. So I caught the bus and went home. Well, we had a guy in the service from New York, and he took his training in Fort Bliss, Texas. He said, it's the only place in the world you can stand in mud up to your neck. Sand will be blowing in your face. It was so cold there in December. I was glad to get out. I spent 17 months over there, and about half the time. Well, I was in 2 years, 10 months, and 10 days. I don't know how many minutes, but I was ready to come home.
And I bet your mother was ready to have you home. Do you remember the look on her face when you walked in the door?
Yeah. She stood there with her arms wide open, tears going down her cheeks. It was just a homecoming to remember. My dad passed away in 38. They wanted to adopt some of the kids out, you know, and she said, no way. She brought them into the world, she'd take them out. So she kept the whole bunch. And how she made it? Of course, with the three of us in the Army, that was $150 a month for her. So I'm sure that's the way she got by. She built a house. She bought 4 acres of land, built a house on it, and was doing real good. She lived to be 85 years old.
She went through quite a bit, huh? Her house burning down, her husband passing away, her boys off at war. I can tell you have a lot of respect and admiration for your mother.
Yes, I did. I really did. She's a little German lady, and she's one of them ladies that when she got ready to fix a meal, it wouldn't take her just 30 minutes, she could have a good meal set on the table.
You know, you told me something else, and I think it's relevant, because when I showed up here, I asked you, you know, how many kids and grandkids you have, and you chuckled a little bit because there's too many to count, and none of them would be here if you didn't make it home from the war, and none of them would be here if you didn't meet your wife. Yeah. So how'd you meet your wife?
We was going to church. I played guitar in church, mm-hmm. And she knew my sister, my younger sister, real well. In fact, they was in school together. Dorothy had kept telling her about me, and she got her guitar and brought it to church one time. I was sitting on one side of the building, and she was sitting on the other side, and a fellow by the name Dewey Stillwell was a guitar player and singer, and she got with him and got to learn, and she got to where she could play 2 or 3 chords. And one day she come down, and I asked her out, and that started it. 6 weeks later, we was married.
Woo.
We was married on June 14th, 1947. She died on November the 10th, 2017.
So I know I'm not the only one listening who would love to be married for 70 years the way you two were. And anytime I meet someone who can say that, I have to ask them, what's the secret? How did you guys do that? How did you make it work for 70 years?
Well, you know, I've heard some people say, they'd never had a quarrel, never. But that didn't work with us. I know I'd do things that upset her, and she'd get right back. She liked to argue, and I never did like to argue. I just, when she'd start that, I'd just walk off. But we got along, and just, I don't know, just one of those things, just an everyday thing, love. I think that's the main ingredient to marriage, love, trust, and obey. Now, I had a young couple come to me during our reunion up in Oregon, and he asked me, he said, what would you suggest for our marriage? And I told him, I said, well, if you base it on love, trust, and obey, you won't go wrong. And that's about the only thing I know what to do. Just when the Lord puts love in your heart, there's no room for anything else. When we first married, she was wanting to learn to play the guitar where she could sing and play. And I'll tell you, that lady couldn't tear a tune a toe sack. She just couldn't sing. She got with a minister, and he told her, said, Gene, I need somebody to lead songs. She told him, said, you know I can't sing. He said, that's all right. She told him, said, you know I can't sing. He said, that's all right. But she got to where she could really sing. And the last song I heard her sing was right up here at Wasco. She sang Beyond the Sunset. She done such a good job. I've wished a lot of times I'd have had my phone, could taped it. Yeah, we had our ups and downs, but we was from Phoenix to Madras, Oregon, Post Falls, Idaho, Searcy, Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas, then back to Oregon. And I think I've worked at every kind of a job there is to work at. But in Arizona, farm work was 50 cents an hour. Come out here and we got $1.25 an hour working for PG&E. So we hit it like we really topping the cotton out here.
When's the last time you played your guitar?
This morning. Yeah, I got three of them there. I got the Dobro, and then I got three electric guitars. The electric guitars all put up by Gibson Company. I've been trying to learn to play them things for about 80 years. I first started to learn in 1935.
How many other 99-year-old guitar players do you know?
I really don't know. But I usually take my guitar to church. I go over in East Bakersfield on Sunday night. My daughter and son-in-law's there, and he plays guitar. I usually take that, and once in a while I'll take my Dobro and play.
So at 99, you're playing with the worship team at your church?
Yep, and sometimes I play by myself. I try to sing once in a while, but I get my voice gets to giving it that, and I can't do anything.
Do you have one particular piece of music that you really enjoy playing?
Of course, I play gospel a lot of times, but I've got one that I used to try to play it quite a bit. And if you want to hear it, I'll try it for you.
You read my mind. Of course, I'd love to hear it. But I don't want to leave anything out that's important to you. So if there's anything I didn't ask you about, feel free to share. And I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for sharing this story with us that only you could share. I am curious to know, when you look back over almost 100 years on this planet, is there something you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
I think it would be my wife and my family. She gave me 5 kids, 3 boys and 2 girls, and I think they're the best kids in the world.
I can tell you're not done yet. You're not just looking back, you're looking forward. So is there anything you're really looking forward to? Is there something you haven't done in almost 100 years that you'd really like to say, yeah, I did that, I saw that, I experienced that?
There's a couple of places I'd like to go, you know. I've been, you might say, almost all over the world, but I've never been to Yellowstone National Park, and there's a Joshua Park in Arizona. My wife and I went through part of it, but I'd like to go back there and take this girl with me. But otherwise, I like to go to church, and I like to play. I've got to where I don't do that good anymore, but I like to try.
I guess we'll be the judge of that. Old Bill Glaspie of Bakersfield, California. You can find video of him with his guitars at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.